Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Protections for Retirement Funds Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On June 12, 2014, the Supreme Court issued its decision in Clark v. Rahmacher. The question in this case is whether an individual retirement account that a debtor has inherited is exempt from the debtor's bankruptcy estate under Section 522 of the Bankruptcy Code, which exempts retirement funds to the extent that those funds are in a fund or account that is exempt from taxation under certain provisions of the Internal Revenue Code. Justice Sotomayor delivered the opinion for a unanimous court, which held that the funds contained in an inherited IRA do not qualify as retirement funds within the meaning of the Bankruptcy Code exemption. The judgment of the Seventh Circuit was affirmed. To discuss the case, we have Jennifer Sprang, who is an associate professor of law at the Arizona Summit Law School. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Sprang.
Never underestimate the power of the "that can't be the law" rule. It probably explains the decision in Clark v. Rahmacher, the United States Supreme Court's most recent tangle with the Impenetrable Bankruptcy Abuse Prevention and Consumer Protection Act of 2005, or BAPCA. When Heidi Heffron Clark was 22 years old, she inherited her mother's individual retirement account. The balance? $450,000. The account still contained $300,000 9 years later, on the day she and her husband filed a joint Chapter 7 bankruptcy petition. The issue in the Clark case was this. Is it a, quote, non-spousal inherited IRA, an exempt asset in a debtor's bankruptcy estate, just like a traditional or Roth IRA? Or is an inherited IRA just a general-purpose savings account that the Clark's bankruptcy trustee should liquidate to pay creditors? To hold that Heidi's inherited IRA was exempt from her bankruptcy estate and therefore protected from liquidation and distribution to her creditors, the Supreme Court would have had to hold that some of Heidi's creditors would go unpaid while Heidi left the bankruptcy process with a cool $300,000 in cash. From between the lines, the court's 11-page unanimous decision could not scream more loudly. That cannot be the law. Except maybe it was. The most important thing about the Bankruptcy Code is that it is a massive regulation of the financial services sector that leaves footprints everywhere. It is a significant determinant of the cost of credit. It seeps directly or indirectly into all sorts of commercial transactions. It drives many estate planning decisions. It influences whether people start and expand small businesses. It is a healthcare financing system for the poor. One theory is that the amount of an individual's indebtedness influences the amount that individual works. Could fewer payments be having a perverse effect on labor market participation? Point. The bankruptcy code, and worse, our poorly drafted one, necessarily distorts individual decision-making and market operation, making both less efficient. It has numerous unforeseen and unintended consequences, and many are not good. The impact of the non-exemptibility of inherited IRAs will probably turn out to be one of them. 40 years ago, Congress authorized the first tax-preferred IRAs to encourage middle-income Americans to save more for retirement. Last year, 40% of American households held $5.7 trillion of assets in IRAs. Baby boomers who are on the cusp of retirement own the most IRAs, and the Gen Xers are close behind. Therefore, in coming decades, the number of IRA owners who pass away and leave IRA accounts to children and other non-spouse beneficiaries will explode. These accounts will constitute the fruits of 4 decades of massive federal taxpayer subsidies for retirement savings. But inherited IRAs are not like other IRAs. a beneficiary of a non-spousal inherited IRA may not make contributions, must make at least minimum withdrawals every year, and may withdraw the entire balance without penalties at any time. Those characteristics indicate Congress had competing goals. It did not want to make IRAs into multi-generational tax shelters, but it did want inherited IRAs to be retirement saving vehicles. Here's how a non-spousal inherited IRA can help people marshal funds for retirement. Many will inherit from someone in a prior generation. Therefore, the prime age for inheritance will be 50 to 59 years of age. Those who inherit from someone in their own generation will usually do so later in life as well. Therefore, a large proportion of beneficiaries will be close to retiring or already retired when they inherit IRAs anyway. It makes sense to allow them access to the cash immediately. But the IRAs they inherit will still be retirement funds by definition. Now, suppose you are the beneficiary of an inherited IRA significantly before you plan to retire. If you take advantage of the incentive structure in Section 408 of the tax code, here's what will happen. You will withdraw only the required minimum amounts based on your life expectancy. The principal will probably grow before retirement day. And on the day of your funeral, your inherited IRA will have a balance of zero. Pretty clever. Inherited IRAs facilitate retirement savings even though you have to make regular withdrawals. The unanimous opinion of the court in Clark, however, acknowledges none of these dynamics that Congress built right into the tax code. As it was, the Clark Court and the parties agreed on quite a few issues. First, they agreed that the case turns on 11 U.S.C. Section 522d12, part of the Basic Federal Bankruptcy Exemption Scheme, which permits debtors to exempt retirement funds to the extent that those funds are in a fund or account that is exempt from taxation under Section 408 of the Internal Revenue Code. Second, the court and the parties also agreed that an asset must have two characteristics to qualify for protection under the retirement funds exemption. The asset must be retirement funds, and the asset must be tax exempt under one of the listed tax code provisions. The Clarks and the court, however, did not agree that Heidi's inherited IRA satisfied those requirements. The account had retained its tax-exempt status pursuant to Section 408 of the tax code. But even though the funds were set aside as retirement funds when Heidi's parents contributed them to the original IRA, the court held that they did not remain retirement funds once Heidi inherited them. Instead, the court read retirement funds to mean that only funds set aside for the debtor's retirement qualified for the exemption. So how could you know if an account contained the debtor's retirement funds? One approach would be to ask. But that led to the third agreement. Both parties hoped that the court would hand down a bright line rule to answer that question and, in effect, determine the exemptability of all inherited IRAs for all time. Neither wanted the case to initiate endless case-by-case bankruptcy court adjudications about whether a debtor actually or intended to use an inherited IRA balance as retirement funds. There was no reason for the court to honor that agreement, but it did. That decision decided the case. Justice Sotomayor never explains why the court rejected a case-by-case approach. The oft-wise explanation is that case-by-case determinations are expensive, and debtors especially cannot afford the litigation. A more cynical reason is that lawyers then end up with the estate's assets instead of creditors or debtors. A third reason is that bankruptcy courts are too busy. BAPCA has clogged up court dockets with so many minor matters, such as reaffirmation agreements, there's much less time for other things. But none of those is convincing as to inherited IRAs. Look, Debtors and creditors fight to the death in evidentiary hearings over the values of rusty Ford pickups every day. Somehow they manage to afford it, including their expert fees, and somehow bankruptcy courts find the time. Surely the system can accommodate individualized attention to accounts containing hundreds of thousands of dollars. Plus, the flip side of cynical attorneys get the money argument is that bankruptcy trustees get paid a percentage of all debtors' assets that they liquidate and distribute to creditors. Inherited IRAs being non-exempt across the board is a retirement program itself for trustees. Besides, marginal trustee compensation rates decline as trustees liquidate and distribute more assets. That fee structure incentivizes quick, debtor-favorable agreements about small sums. There is no reason other than the culture of a court or the local U.S. trustee's office to waste assets fighting over the smaller accounts that will provide many debtors with dignity at retirement. Bankruptcy judges and trustees also develop informal standards to create predictability and minimize litigation, such as, if the debtor has retired, the account is exempt. If the debtor has not retired, but routinely withdraws little more than the minimum amount required by law, the inherited IRA should be presumed to be exempt. But the court accepted the party's invitation instead and announced a bright-line rule. It would look to the legal characteristics of the account in which the funds are held, asking whether, as an objective matter, the account is one set aside for the day when an individual stops working. The court then discussed those characteristics that distinguish non-spousal inherited IRAs from other IRAs and quickly concluded none was consistent with the characteristics of retirement funds. But did Congress really intend to marshal so much taxpayer money for the benefit of finance companies and credit card lenders? I don't know about that. The court's brief nod to non-textual evidence of congressional intent is just form language about the careful balance between the interests of creditors and debtors embedded in the federal bankruptcy scheme, particularly as to exemptions. But the federal exemption scheme internalizes more specific policies. Read the bankruptcy provisions on exemptions, priorities, dischargeability, you name it. The bankruptcy code protects the government when its financial interests are at stake. The Clark decision is therefore out of touch with the government's interest in the disposition of tax-preferred retirement savings and is odd in that respect. The decision then observes that while other IRAs ensure that owners can provide for basic needs in retirement, inherited IRAs may actually encourage the beneficiary to splurge on sports cars or vacation homes. Yes, they may, but most IRAs do not have large enough balances to pay for those sorts of luxury goods. I know what many of my former bankruptcy clients actually would do. Take the money and pay off their houses or cars so high-dollar loan and rent payments will not take such a big bite out of what may be a very modest fixed pension or Social Security income at retirement. People fund their retirements in many ways. Neither we nor the court can be sure what Congress intended when it added the retirement funds exemption to Section 522. And when in doubt, the "that can't be the law" rule is pretty persuasive. But the Clark decision will ultimately effectuate a massive transfer of what were once your tax dollars at work to the nation's consumer credit industry. That can't be the law either.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia. Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.